Welcome to The Point. I'm Mindy Todd. We've seen a lot of changes in the first 6 months of the Trump administration, including the restructuring and elimination of some of the federal agencies and drastic cuts to most federal programs. The consensus is that lower income individuals and families will be impacted the most by cuts to federal programs. Our focus today is how changes in federal programs and budgets will impact women's access to health care. Joining us, Julia Keough. She's president and CEO of Health Imperatives. Hi, Julia.
Hi, Mindy. Thanks for having me.
Sure. Rebecca Hart Holder, president of Reproductive Equity Now. Hi, Becca.
Hi, Mindy.
So, Julia, give us some background on the mission and work of Health Imperatives, including the history of how you got started.
Sure, absolutely. So Health Imperatives is a multi-service healthcare and social service organization that's dedicated to reducing health and wealth disparities while advancing meaningful opportunities and economic security for individuals and families south of Boston. We started as a single rape crisis center and family planning clinic in Brockton in 1977. And since then, we've sort of grown throughout the southeastern part of the state to address the multiple needs of people who fall through cracks of mainstream systems of healthcare, housing, and other economic systems. Today, we have 7 sexual and reproductive health clinics in Hyannis, Martha's Vineyard, Nantucket, Wareham, New Bedford, Plymouth, and Brockton. And in addition to that, we have a number of other services, including domestic violence shelter, rape crisis counseling, and more recently, housing for survivors of sex trafficking. We also provide all the health care for youth in the Department of Youth Services in Southeastern Mass and run the WIC Nutrition Assistance Program for women, infants, and children. In addition to that, what we do is we look at what are the gaps in the services that we're providing, or what are the particular needs in these diverse communities that range from really, you know, urban centers to rural islands, and how are we local as well as regional? And to that end, we regularly try to address the changing needs of these communities by adding initiatives like for young parents or LGBTQIA plus youth or immigrants.
Right. And Becca, give us some background on the mission and work of Reproductive Equity Now.
Thanks, Mindy. Reproductive Equity Now is an organization based in Massachusetts, but we are a regional organization. We work to make the full spectrum of reproductive health care available and accessible to all New Englanders without barriers based on your zip code, how much money is in your bank account, your gender, your race, your immigration status. And while we focus on all reproductive health care, we do really see abortion care as one of the key issues that we fight for.
Let's start the conversation in June of 2022. That's when we saw the Supreme Court overturn Roe versus Wade, concluding the U.S. Constitution does not protect the right to an abortion. Abortion has been framed as a moral issue. It's also a health issue. And when we see states passing legislation to totally ban abortion, even to save the life of a pregnant person, it's scary to think that some women will die because they'll be denied access to abortion care. Becca, describe some of the risks associated with pregnancy and instances when the termination of a pregnancy is life-saving care.
Yeah. Well, I would argue that ending a pregnancy is always life-saving care for many people because they are making a decision about what's right for their future, whether that's their economic future, their educational future. But those are deeply personal decisions about if, when, and how to become a parent. And it is impossible for politicians to legislate about how people and women specifically should be able to live their lives. There are, of course, instances where people have wanted pregnancies where something life-threatening happens. And those are often devastating. You know, we see all kinds of things like preeclampsia, fetal anomalies that happen. And these are deeply personal decisions that people need to make with their healthcare provider. And, you know, what we're seeing in states like Texas and Georgia, where there have been bans, is that doctors are afraid to provide care in those so-called exceptional situations. And so they wait until a woman is septic and on the verge of death before even providing care, if they're able to provide that care at all. And I want to be clear, that's not the fault of the doctors. That is the fault of laws that are criminalizing basic health care.
Right. Julie, you want to add anything to that?
Yeah, I mean, I think Becca and I would probably agree that Massachusetts is the best place to be doing this work. And we're so lucky, Health Imperatives is so lucky to have an advocacy organization like Reproductive Equity Now and the Healy Driscoll administration and the legislature who have really prioritized access to abortion care and women's health in general, and have taken all sorts of measures to make sure that we could provide services to people from other states. I think that they've led the country in this way.
Yeah. So Massachusetts law includes constitutional protections for abortion, but the state does have restrictions, right? So what are the provisions of Massachusetts law around abortion? And Beck, I guess that's a question for you.
Yeah, well, let me start by saying that the legislature realized well before the Dobbs decision that it was likely that the right to privacy would fall. When Justice Kennedy resigned and Justice Kavanaugh was appointed, it was quite clear the direction that we were heading. So Massachusetts did have a pre-Roe criminal abortion ban. So if Roe fell, abortion care would have been criminalized in the state, and that was repealed. I believe in 2020. We w have worked very hard to try to repeal restrictions in Massachusetts law. And there are two big ones that exist right now that I want to point out. One is that we have what's called a gestational ban, which means you can't access care post 24 weeks. And that is often in a moment when you're facing a lot of, pressure, extreme stress because you've had a diagnosis related to a wanted pregnancy. There are exceptions, and we worked with the legislature to create those exceptions. But no exceptions regime can really, explain the full measure of issues that happen in pregnancy for women and account for everything that happens to a woman in pregnancy. So right now, Massachusetts is unfortunately sending people out of state who need care later in pregnancy. And that is simply not a safe thing to do, especially in Trump's America. The other big issue that we have is that we have a ban on people receiving abortion care without parental consent if they are under the age of 16. We were able to repeal part of that law with the Roe Act. So it used to be that you couldn't receive that care under the age of 18, and we repealed that law down to 16. We do know that that disproportionately impacts low-income communities and communities of color. These are often people who simply cannot safely receive parental consent for a variety of reasons. And so we're making them jump through unnecessary hoops in order to access the care that they need.
Yeah. Julia, you want to add anything to that, or she did Becca cover it pretty much?
She covered it. She did an
Okay.
excellent
Yeah.
job.
All right. So there might be listeners who believe abortion should be allowed to save the life of a pregnant person, but are uncomfortable with situations when a healthy person with a healthy pregnancy decides to have an abortion. How do you respond to that sentiment?
Simply say, you are allowed to have that opinion. There is no reason that anyone should take your right to have your own opinion away from you. It is very different to legislate on that opinion. So if you choose to not have abortion care, that is a great decision for you. But it is wrong to put a politician in the medical exam room with a patient and a doctor and have that person dictate what someone should do with their body.
Yeah, I would add, I think that Becca mentioned this earlier, that we talk a lot about life saving and valuing what decision makes the most sense. But we're Health Imperatives is really dedicated to providing assistance to people who otherwise wouldn't get it. And it's a huge economic burden. And I think what's really important to note is that people who haven't had access to meaningful opportunities, whether it's education or employment, they don't have adequate housing. Often we see mothers who have multiple children who can't afford another. There is a judgment about that decision, but in fact, that could affect the whole rest of their lives and their other children. So I feel like we need to shift away from that to see what are the responses that we could have to these families who are struggling right now on the Cape and Islands to meet their basic needs. And we focus so much on this one issue rather than looking at, the whole picture of what it's like to not have enough money to meet your basic needs living in one of the most expensive areas of one of the most expensive states in the country.
Yeah. So, Julia, what are the options for people on the Cape, Nantucket, or the Vineyard seeking abortion care?
So right now, this area used to be considered an abortion desert until Becca and her, colleagues and the legislature and the administration came together to make funding available for organizations like Health Imperatives to add medication abortion, in our case, throughout Southeastern Mass. So as of July 2022, 23, we started offering medication abortion, which is two pills, up to 10 weeks and 6 days. And most people we see are opting for medication abortion. The other type of abortion is procedural abortion, and some people choose that, and some people need it after 10 weeks and 6 days, or if there are other complications. So that is still a gap in Southeastern Mass. We work very closely with other providers, particularly Planned Parenthood, to help people who need that type of abortion get to where they're going. And I think, that's a challenge, but I will say that providing health care in Southeastern Mass, the Cape and Islands, and parts of the South Coast and South Shore, also people have challenges getting any kind of care, whether it's cancer care, cardiac care. So I think this is just one piece of what is a real issue for people on the Cape and Islands and South Coast.
You mentioned the procedural abortion. Where do they go for that? Is it, do you have to leave the area?
Attleboro,
Okay.
Providence, or Boston.
Which can be quite a trek if you're coming from one of the islands, right?
Yes. But again, I think that the state really putting funding out so that all of us could add this capacity has made a difference because there are funds for people to travel, and we have funds for staff who provide counseling and support and case management for people and really help make it happen. Because when someone is needing medical care, a lot of the time they can't deal with all of the logistics of it. So I think we've made a lot of progress in terms of collaborating, and I will say that all these organizations work together really well to provide the type of care that people need despite the barriers.
866-999-4626 is our number if you'd like to join our conversation this morning. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org, and we'll talk more after a quick break. You're listening to The Point. We're talking about women's access to health care this morning with Julia Keough, President and CEO of Health Imperatives, and Rebecca Hart Holder, President of Reproductive Equity Now. 866-999-4626 is our number. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. Abortion is only one part of reproductive health care. Julia, Health Imperatives provides comprehensive sexual health care to everyone and anyone. So tell us about those services.
Absolutely. So, as you mentioned, our services are available to anyone regardless of health insurance status, immigration status, or ability to pay. Having said that, we focus on people who otherwise wouldn't receive this critical care. So, about 40% of the people we serve about 10,000 people throughout the seven clinics each year, have no access to preventive care. So they may have no health insurance or health insurance that's only for catastrophic care. That is a major issue for us because most of those people are people who aren't eligible for care because of their immigration status. And some are people who are working and making relatively good money, but still can't afford health care and food and housing in this area. Another 25 to 30% of the people we serve are on Medicaid because of their incomes, their low incomes, and then the remainder are using private insurance. We serve people from multiple different countries, particularly on the islands, and we have our sexual reproductive health staff, 60% are multilingual, bilingual or multilingual, which is really I think, critical for us to be able to provide this care to people who sometimes this is the only health care they get. So, in addition to birth control and pregnancy testing and abortion or options counseling, we provide annual exams, cancer screenings, and more recently, biopsies because we found people weren't going off island or the Cape to get critical biopsies. So a lot of prevention, HIV prevention, hepatitis C treatment, and gender affirming care for both adults and adolescents.
Wow, sounds like you really cover it all, Julia.
Yeah.
Becca, there are growing health care and disease prevention disparities between those with resources and those without. What are some of the trends that we're seeing?
Great question. One thing that I want to flag is the disparities that we see with access to the full spectrum of reproductive health care services for people who live in rural areas of Massachusetts. And even though it is a very popular place, I would still consider the Cape and Islands to be a more rural area because of the lack of transit infrastructure. So one of the most important innovations that we've seen across the healthcare space, but particularly in reproductive health care, is the advent of telehealth and how important it can be for patients to be able to reach a clinician through Zoom, through their computer, and be able to access care. And in the case of abortion, have the medication mailed directly to them. But many of the things that Julia named can be done over telehealth, but of course you can't do a biopsy through a computer. So you need to make sure that people in rural areas, people in cities where there are not a lot of clinics in a given area, have access to transit so that they can get the care they need. But we do see, nationwide, not just in Massachusetts, a real disproportionate impact on people living in rural America and their access to reproductive health care.
Julia, as you
And I
mentioned,
think
oh, go ahead. No, go ahead. Go ahead.
I was just going to add locally, I think that one of the big issues for rural areas and the Cape and Islands in particular is the way government funding is allocated. So typically it's based on population, the size of the population, and doesn't take into consideration geography, which in the case of the islands is an even bigger issue. So we've often not had adequate funding to have on-island staff to provide these services. So we've had to raise private funding to do that. And I think that we need to look at the whole system. And while telehealth is a huge and very important advance, it is really important to have these clinics in these communities. And in Nantucket, for example, we're the only community-based health center at all that provides care to people without insurance. And in Martha's Vineyard, there are other healthcare providers, but again, it's very difficult for people to access care if we weren't there. And so I think that one of the things we're most concerned about is with organizations like ours that rely so heavily on government funding, we're not only seeing the sort of death by a thousand cuts or these, assault, honestly, on our programs and the people we serve, but the way government funds our programs is fundamentally flat year after year after year, and yet our costs of doing business, particularly around healthcare, are skyrocketing. So I think it's really very concerned about growing health disparities if we aren't able to figure out how to, really increase funding to support the infrastructure.
Yeah, it's because that was going to be my next question. Costs are going
Oh,
up,
sorry.
and of course, what your funding model is. So that's got to be, I guess, if there's something you're losing sleep over at night, it's how do we fund all these programs when we serve everybody, right?
Absolutely. I said, but one thing that happened to Health Imperatives in May was we got our new quote for what our health insurance for employees was going to be. And it was so high that we had to lay 11 people off. And that was a very difficult decision. And really ironic that a healthcare organization that is providing care to people who can't afford it can't afford its own insurance premiums.
Wow. Tell us more about the Title 10 program. What was it designed to do, and who is it meant to serve?
Well, so Title 10 is the government, the federal program that supports sexual and reproductive health care, and it's really designed to help address the needs of people around birth control, fundamentally. It doesn't fund abortion, but it's supposed to help people who otherwise can't afford to pay for that care. And so Health Imperatives receives Title X funding through the Department of Public Health, and it is an essential funding stream for the seven clinics we have, but it's just one funding stream.
Yeah. Becca?
Indeed, the Title X program, I just want to back up, give people a little bit of context, is a federal program that has existed for decades. And in many states like Massachusetts, funding goes through the State Department of Public Health, not in every state, but it is then given to organizations like Julia's. And the Title X program is an absolutely essential piece of infrastructure for providing reproductive health care. It is vitally important to people who are low income to make sure that they can get the cancer screenings, STI screenings, contraception, pregnancy-related care that they need, want, and deserve. Cuts from the federal government are going to have an absolutely devastating impact on the
Yeah.
ability to deliver those services.
A recent New York Times article noted that under the Trump administration, the focus of Title X seems to be shifting from providing contraception to low-income individuals to promoting pregnancy and combating infertility, all in line with calls to increase the birth rate in the country. Becca, infertility is a problem for many people, and we know that infertility treatments are very expensive. If you have financial means and good insurance, you likely can get infertility treatment. How would you respond to those who would like to see federal funding for infertility treatments? And then, Julie, I'd love to hear your thoughts on that as well.
Yeah, I would like to see the pie increase dramatically. We can have the Title X program that helps people in their reproductive lives and also fund infertility treatments. People deserve funding for infertility treatments. In Massachusetts, we have a state insurance mandate to make sure that infertility treatment is paid for. I am the proud parent of a child who was conceived using infertility treatment. I wouldn't be able to be a parent without it, and I wouldn't have been able to afford it unless we had the insurance mandate that Massachusetts had. But these two things are not mutually exclusive. We can have both. We can have robust federal funding for contraception and STI screenings and cancer prevention, and we can have robust federal funding for infertility treatment.
Yeah, Mindy, if I could add, I absolutely agree. I do think, though, that it's really important to look at when you're looking at services and benefits for low-income people in this country, how they've eroded over time, whether we're talking about cuts to SNAP, nutrition assistance, the rising homelessness epidemic in Massachusetts. There are so many challenges that the government isn't able to meet right now that I think at this point in time, we again have to look beyond what are just the sexual reproductive health needs of an individual, but what are the overall needs of that person? And then decide, is there enough money to provide housing? What are basic rights and what are basic needs? And I think all of these things are really important, but if we don't step back and look and see what should the government be putting money into, and preventive care is really, really critical. And I'm very concerned that as we see these cuts or just the level funding that's eroding over time, that we're going to see increased rates of cervical cancer, and that disproportionately impacts Black women, and all the gains that we've made in the last decades are going to erode. So
Yeah.
I just want to keep bringing it back to, like, what are we doing? This is a very difficult time, and I like to lead with hope, and I think that that's how we're continuing to provide our services. We haven't been really cut yet. We're doing what we can, but at the same time, it's so serious right now that we really need to figure out a way how to bring funding in for the people who are working on the Cape and Islands, who are making those communities run, who aren't going to be able to do it anymore.
Right. So, Julia, how much of your funding comes from Title X and this shift? Is that going to impact the population you serve?
Yeah, I mean, so we get about a little over $1 million from Title X and another $1 million from Medicaid. So that's about 10% of our overall budget. We do get other federal funding, which also could be at risk. So we're just very concerned about, what could happen and what that would mean from the lowest income people. Because again, we're one of the only organizations in the area that provides these sexual reproductive health services, but also one of the only ones in the country that's really working with the lowest income people. And so we're very concerned about any actions that could make it even more difficult for us to serve the people we're serving today.
Yeah, you mentioned Medicaid, and of course, we've heard a lot of talk about cuts to Medicaid, which aren't slated to happen until after the midterm elections in 2026. I'm sure you're very concerned about how this is going to impact the services you provide.
Extremely, because what's going to happen is there are going to be more people who are going to be in need of our care and won't have the insurance to cover it. And if our infrastructure hasn't been bolstered by then, we won't be able to address that. And, the other issue is the Medicaid defunding issue, which is still being looked at, but for organizations that provide abortion that also bill for cancer screenings, for annual exams that may not be able to do that. And we're still looking at that. So I think what's challenging is there are all these individual actions that are happening one at a time, and each day you wake up, you don't know what it's going to be. And altogether, it's an outright assault on the people that we're serving and our programs. And I think that's what keeps me up at night.
Yeah. Becca, what are your thoughts on that? I imagine you lose sleep over it as well.
I lose sleep over a lot of things. The point I want to make about what has happened in the big ugly bill is that it is a backdoor abortion ban. The president knows very well that access to abortion is popular. And what Justice Alito said in the Dobbs decision was that we should turn over the decision about the legality of abortion to the states. And when that happened, there was really a very big divide. Some states, roughly 20, acted immediately to ban abortion care. And states like Massachusetts stepped up and did something different and not only funded access to the full spectrum of reproductive health care, but also created a law to protect providers. That law has had a profound impact on the ability for people in red states to continue to access abortion care because they are receiving medication abortion through the mail. The federal government doesn't like that. The Trump administration, and by that I mean the Trump administration, does not like that. That was not the intent of the Dobbs decision. The intent of the Dobbs decision was to outlaw abortion care. And so, this big ugly bill is really a way to get at states who have affirmed the right to reproductive freedom and to say, we are not going to let you do it, even though we are states' rights people, even though Justice Alito, was very clear in the Dobbs decision. This is a way to try to ban abortion piece by piece in a federal funding bill.
Right. We've seen programs like Planned Parenthood get defunded because in some states they offer abortion care. Becca, for those who aren't familiar with Planned Parenthood, what kinds of health care do they provide?
Well, like health imperatives, Planned Parenthood provides abortion care, but also contraceptive access, cancer screenings, STI screenings and treatment, gender-affirming care in some states, pregnancy-related care. It is part of the vital puzzle that exists for people to get reproductive health care nationwide, including in Massachusetts.
So, some states have passed laws that would criminalize abortion care providers, even if they performed to save the life of a pregnant person. How do you describe how this is? You sort of touched on this earlier, Becca. How is this changing patient care?
In profoundly scary ways, it is making clinicians who want to do what is in the best interest of their patients afraid to do that because they are afraid of the criminal repercussions and the civil penalties that could result if they provide basic health care to people. So we're not only seeing it in what we talked about before, where, there are physicians who are afraid to provide life-saving abortion care in emergency situations. But we're also seeing the closure of labor and delivery in many states where, listen, pregnancy is complicated. And sometimes people have to end a pregnancy, even when it's a wanted pregnancy. And there are a lot of interventions that have to happen that are unique to the individual presenting. And doctors are saying, this state is too restrictive. I cannot safely provide care for my patients here. And then we're seeing labor and delivery wards close around the country. We're also seeing a change to the training regime. So, people who are in states that have banned abortion, who are trying to get trained as OBGYNs, are not getting the same kind of training that people in Massachusetts get. And that is going to be devastating for healthcare access across the country.
Yeah, Jill, you mentioned the federal funding that you get. Do you get funding from the state?
Absolutely. Most of the funding we get to run the clinics is from the state. And that's, again, a reason why we're so lucky to be in Massachusetts.
Yeah, cuts to federal programs put more pressure on state budgets, and with federal cuts to education, the environment, and other programs, state budgets are getting pulled in many directions. What are you hearing about funding from the state going forward?
So we're still waiting to hear what's going to happen, but I think that we are, confident on the one hand that this is a priority, but on the other hand, because there are so many cuts, they just don't know whether or not or if they will be able to make up cuts from the federal government in sexual and reproductive health. In 2016, the first Trump administration, they promulgated a rule that prevented organizations from even mentioning abortion or doing options counseling and taking Title X. And at that time, all of the Massachusetts providers who received Title X, including Health Imperatives, returned it to the federal government, and Massachusetts was able to make up the difference. If that happens again, and I think we're pretty sure that something like that will happen again at the federal level, we don't know whether or not the state will be able to make it up. And that's why what we're trying to do is to really shift and sort of diversify our funding and look to increasing private funding from individuals, foundations, and corporations, because we have this infrastructure, we have this incredible work, and all we actually need is adequate funding.
Yeah, so much uncertainty. We're talking about women's access to health care with Julia Keough, President and CEO of Health Imperatives, and Rebecca Hart Holder, President of Reproductive Equity Now. 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. And we'll talk more after a quick break. You're listening to The Point. We're talking about changes in federal programs and budgets that will impact women's access to health care. We're talking with Julia Keough, President and CEO of Health Imperatives, and Rebecca Hart Holder, President of Reproductive Equity Now. 866-999-4626 is our number. If you have a comment or a question, that's 866-999-4626. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. Becca, Massachusetts, as we were mentioning, progressive state with protections for abortion. But if we don't have funding, do we still have rights and access to this care?
Yes, that is the crucial answer. That's a crucial question right there. And the answer is no. Without meaningful funding for access, it is a legal right that we cannot exercise. I want to be really clear about something that Julia said earlier, which I think really gets to the heart of the issue here. We have to be realistic. We have extraordinary state leadership who has shown up for issues, in reproductive health care, in education, in immigrants' rights, in housing justice, many, many things that I care deeply about. And state leadership alone does not have the funds to undo the damage that the federal government under President Trump is doing. It's simply impossible because of the scale of what is happening. So your question is the perfect one, Mindy. If we don't have money from the federal government, Bay Staters are going to suffer, full stop.
So what can we do on the local and state level to advocate for healthcare services to continue this in our communities? It's this, like you're saying, we might have, state leaders who want to get this accomplished, but very difficult when, the federal government is saying something different. So what do we do?
Well, a couple of things. One, I think we do have to push for state funding, and we do have to think really critically about how the state can invest. It is not going to be at the same scale that the federal government can invest, and we can't expect that. But we do have to think very critically about state investments. What Julia said earlier is also right. We need to be thinking about private foundations, about individual donors who can stand up in their communities and invest. I think the key right now is really local action, really looking around at your community and thinking, okay, who do I see offering reproductive health care? That's an issue that I care deeply about. So how can I get involved? How can I support health imperatives? Is it a $5 a month donation? Is it a house party? Is it a check at the end of the year? Little things really add up. And I think that's one of the most important things across many issue areas that we can be doing is investing in the people in our communities who are stepping up to this fight.
And Julia, are you finding that's happening? Are you finding as you're going out and trying to get more private money that people are responding?
I have to say that I think we're very well known in terms of individuals who need our services. People in the communities we serve know us. I think we're less known among potential donors. So we're definitely increasing our fundraising efforts, but I think we need to sort of do more of that. And I think to your question about what everyone can do in these communities, I think it's important for people on the Cape and Islands to advocate for the particular needs of the Cape and Islands because, we serve some of the poorest communities in the state, notably Brockton and New Bedford. And yet I would say that Nantucket and Martha's Vineyard are equally top priorities for us, as well as the Cape, but particularly the island issue, because there's no other way for people to get that care. So I think in talking about, we definitely need more money, but we also need to do business differently. And I think that's something that the state can do. I think there are a lot of regulations, a lot of requirements that take a lot of our time that can be looked at and figure out what do we really need to support these programs. And how is an investment going to save money over time? And what's really different about the Cape and Islands, I think, is this explosive cost of living. Ever since COVID, we saw, people with significant means coming in and buying homes, which is terrific, but it's had a real impact on working people and people who, can't meet their basic needs. And that's just getting worse. And I think if we look at this big, hideous bill and what it is intended to do, as there is more of a transfer of resources away from working people and people living in poverty to people with means, that's something that's going to impact these communities. And there's got to be a community response to it, whether it's what the community's investing themselves and how they're voting and talking to the state or the federal government.
Yeah. We're talking a lot too about what, there's a lot of uncertainty in what might happen and what money might go away. But are there examples, Julia, now of people being denied access to care because of this lack of funding currently?
No, I think that's again why we love being in Massachusetts. We've done everything we can. I have the best board in the world because they allow us to use all the funding that we have as much as we can to make sure we're paying as close to a living wage as possible and that we're filling needs in the community. For example, the same year that we offered abortion access, we started a house for women who've been trafficked, who have substance use disorders and mental health concerns, because we saw they were falling through the cracks more than anyone else, and there was no other model like the one that we were developing. We didn't have all the money for it, but the board said it's such an important need, do it. So we've raised that money, but that means that because we're constantly investing in the communities and our staff, we don't have a lot of money to fall back on. And so I think that's where, having private funding that can really will allow us to be more flexible and address these, challenges or these, next few years. But right now, we are still serving anyone who comes to us, and we want that to be the most important message, that nothing's changed. You can still come to us. We'll still provide free care. No matter what happens, we're going to be doing free care until we close our doors, which we're not going to do.
Right.
So
Yeah. So, Becca, is that true? Are we seeing that for the rest of the state, or are there areas that people are being denied access to care?
well, I Certainly, there are people who are being denied access to care later in pregnancy, and who have to leave the state because of our law. What the legislature did following Dobbs was invest about $17 million in abortion infrastructure statewide, and a pocket of that money was roughly $2 million for what are called abortion funds, and those are mutual aid organizations. There are three in our state who people can call if they don't have enough money to obtain abortion care, and the fund will pledge money to an organization like Planned Parenthood or Health Imperatives. I predict, because of what has happened with the big ugly bill and the fact that Medicaid won't be able, or Planned Parenthood, for example, won't be able to take patients who are on Medicaid or MassHealth for abortion care, is that the demand on abortion funds is going to go up dramatically. So that $2 million, I would suspect, in a few years, is not going to be enough money. So right now, we're in a very steady place, thanks to leadership from people like Julia, but I think it remains to be seen what will happen in a couple of years once we really feel the impact of the big ugly bill.
As
And I think,
okay,
oh, can I just add, sorry, that
go ahead.
the rising cost of healthcare is something that's continuing. And again, that's something I think we can advocate, locally, on what that impact is to the state legislature, because, I wonder if there's a way that they can limit the percentage that health insurance companies can raise on nonprofits who are doing the services that the Commonwealth is buying. But over time, if there isn't some sort of check on these rates, it's going to drive us to reduce our workforce and serve fewer people. And that's true for health insurance and also malpractice insurance. It's great that the Shield Law that the legislature is working on had, the update that Becca worked on, that was fantastic. And it has a provision that you can't discriminate against providers of abortion. But what they can do is charge you a lot of money that makes it more and more difficult to provide the services that you're providing.
And as we mentioned earlier, there are many states that have passed abortion bans after the overturn of Roe versus Wade. Are there indications that people from other states are seeking care in Massachusetts? Becca, you're nodding your head.
Absolutely. Yes, absolutely. The latest data from the Department of Public Health, which is from 2023, saw a 597% increase in people traveling for care. Our providers are seeing people from Alabama, from Mississippi, from the Dakotas, from Texas, from all over, for lots of reasons. One is that we have some of the best healthcare in the nation, so Massachusetts is a place to come. But the other is that as states that border states where there's a ban, so think Illinois bordering Missouri, as there's an influx of people from Missouri to Illinois to get abortion care, there's only a limited number of abortion providers. And there starts to be a tidal wave, right? There starts to be a ripple outward where people then have to go to Pennsylvania for care. And then the clinics in Pennsylvania are full. And so people go to Massachusetts for care. And so we haven't seen the kind of increase that in Illinois has, but we have seen a huge increase. And I think that's only going to continue to grow.
We talked earlier about the abortion pill and how that is helping people live in remote or, rural areas. Becca, are there currently legal challenges to the abortion pill, and do you have concerns that access to this medication could be curtailed in the future?
Yes, I do have serious concerns. Last year, there was a case from the Northern District of Texas where a group of plaintiffs challenged the FDA's authorization of mifepristone, which is one of two drugs in the medication abortion regimen. That Mifepristone was approved 20 years ago. There is 20 years worth of data about not only the efficacy, but the safety of mifepristone. It is a very highly studied drug. Those, anti-abortion groups tried to go in and revoke that authorization. That was it ultimately, for procedural reasons, went up to the Supreme Court and then was kicked back down. And we're sort of waiting to see what the groups do. But Secretary Kennedy has made clear in his appointments to the FDA that they are looking at mifepristone. So I do have very serious concerns about what the federal government will do with this very safe, very highly regulated drug.
And Julia, you're
I do
nodding your
as
head.
well. Yeah, I do as well. And I think the point about how safe mifepristone is can't be overstated. It's safer than Tylenol and Viagra. And I think that's an important point to make because this is all an assault on women's, economic empowerment, female empowerment, health. And I think that it's, needs to be stated.
And as we mentioned earlier, birth control and abortion care is a small facet to women's sexual health care. We've talked about screenings for STDs and cancers. If we don't prevent these diseases or catch them early, what are the human and economic costs? Either one of you.
Astronomical, astronomical. And I think we've seen that already when we started adding the colposcopy, which is a procedure to see if there are cancerous cells. And we found that people on Martha's Vineyard weren't going off when they'd have an abnormal pap. They wouldn't go off island. And then, who knows what could have happened. So we got a donor to donate the colposcopy machine because it wasn't covered by our grants. And we started seeing women who, hadn't had any health care in some cases, who had stage three or four cancer. And so, it was very alarming. So we started to make sure that we had this capacity to do this in all of our clinics by raising private money. But what's really disturbing, I think, is that once someone has cancer, they are covered in Massachusetts by Medicaid, by MassHealth. But these women who don't, because of immigration status or because they can't afford it, weren't covered for prevention. So I think that's another reason why organizations like Health Imperatives that are funded through the Department of Public Health that provide additional money for people to be able to do screenings in addition to Title X are so important because that's gonna, I mean, we've seen it. We've seen what happens when people don't have access. And it's so preventable. And there are so many studies showing the racial disparities. And it's just literally black and white.
And this, I mean, prevention, when you think about it, what doesn't make sense is preventative care in the long run is way less expensive than waiting till some of these, diseases or conditions are, like you say, stage three or four. And I mean, it's so surprising that we don't spend more on preventative care.
And that's what I was mentioning when we were talking about the infertility is that there are so many things that we can't do now that are, would be more cost effective. And the government is always in this very difficult position of do they focus on the people with the greatest emergency needs or do they focus on prevention? And when you have so many emergencies like we have now with healthcare, with housing, with food insecurity, we have to make sure we're addressing that. And then there isn't enough for prevention. And that's why it's so important to have multiple stakeholders coming together and saying, what should our communities be doing? How do we leverage private and public funds to make a difference in our communities?
And I'm just thinking too, what you're mentioning, the food insecurity, the housing cost. There's so many things, and for many women who can't afford this pregnancy, or as Becky, you were mentioning earlier, there's so many personal decisions involved. The stress of all of that also impacts our health. We know what stress, we have many studies to show what stress does on this. And this is just, compiling stress upon stress.
Yeah, and the consequences can be deadly. I mean, if you going back to the cancer example, people can't get cancer screenings, but they can still get cancer, right? And we know not just in reproductive health, but in all health, that preventative care is what changes people's lives. And the fact that we aren't doing that, the fact that we aren't making it easier for people to decide if, when, and how to become a parent is, it's a really shameful moment in our country.
Less than a minute left. Julia, what are your final thoughts?
Well, again, I think overall, I'm so grateful to be here with partners like Becca and being in Massachusetts. But I'm, really concerned about growing disparities in the islands and the Cape and South Coast, and hope that we can all come together to figure out how to address the particular needs of those communities.
We're going to post a link with more information about health imperatives and reproductive equity now at our website, capeandislands.org. Julia Keough, President and CEO of Health Imperatives, and Rebecca Hartholder, President of Reproductive Equity Now. Thanks for being with us, and thanks so much for the work that you do.
Thank
Thank
you,
you.
Mindy.
I'm Mindy Todd. Thanks for listening.
The Point is produced by Amy Vince. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Production assistance from Jenny Junker and Dan Tridle. Theme music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter.